Ladies and gentlemen, can I have your attention, please? We are starting the second panel of the day under the guidance and direction of Peter Callamy as the moderator. Peter has had, and you'll see from his bio in the program, a long and distinguished career in the business of journalism from practice to academe. And his particular constant theme was taking an understanding of science and communicating it to the public, and making that a theme that he followed in many applications in journalism. He has done it with extraordinary success and distinction and recognition. Peter, the panel.
Thank you, Bob. Well, we certainly have a reasonably hard act to follow. Anything that stretches all the way from recycled Viagra to water nerds is not going to be easily topped, but I think if you read the bios of the panelists in your program, you'll see that we certainly have the firepower to do that. I want to say just one word from an ancient memory, which is back in the mid-1970s. I was based in London, England, as a correspondent, and I went and did an interview with Barbara Ward, Lady Jackson, more formally, but Barbara Ward, as she was, and sometime around about 75 or 76. This is so far back that this isn't in a database anywhere, so I couldn't look it up, right? This is in clippings, those old-fashioned things that they have in newspapers. And she was in the midst of writing a booklet for a UN conference, which I think might have been the Mar del Plata conference on water, somewhere around 76. And she was definitely writing a booklet about water. She was also dying, and she knew she was dying, and she looked like she was dying, and she died very shortly afterwards. But she said, when we talked, she said, "I am going to finish this book because there is nothing more important than bringing to the attention of people the vital need to deal better with water on our earth and what we do with it. It is the blood, lifeblood of the world." That was 1976 or thereabout, and from what we heard so far this morning, I don't think anything's changed in terms of the vital need and people's dedication to doing it. And maybe one of the ways into this problem, in addition to the governance issue which we heard about, is also to try to get the economics better understood and find the right economic levers to pull as right, as well as the right leadership levers and the right political levers. So we're going to hear from our four panelists basically on that general theme, and we're going to start off with Professor Peter Brown.
We're going to take 8 to 10 minutes.
Clock's not running yet, though, right?
No, not running yet.
It's this one here. This one.
There you go.
No, it's the wrong one.
Oops. Sorry, sir.
It's this one here. Okay, good. Thank you very much. So, thank you, Peter. And much of what I have to say will be is kind of a striking out in a new territory. I'm going to talk about water as a fiduciary good, and I think this relates very strongly to many of the things that have been said already, what Karen mentioned about the public trust doctrine, about the need for a sort of adequate spokesperson for water in Canada, that kind of thing. So I've put together a presentation on this conception, and I've relied very heavily on Richard Layen, who's here in the audience, who's a graduate student here at McGill in the Faculty of Law. And the strategy of this presentation is basically to look at the concept of a fiduciary good and fiduciary duties within the common law tradition. So I think it will complement what Madeline Kenton-Kuman will say, coming from the civil law tradition. And I hope these two presentations come together very well. Before I start, I should thank Robert Slater for mentioning Water Ethics, the book that Jeremy Schmidt and I have done. Jeremy's here in the audience. Also, I want to start with an image. This is from it's a painting by William Waterhouse, Ulysses and the Sirens. And this is a sort of metaphor, I think, for where we are. If you recall this story, Ulysses is warned by Circe that as he passes through this narrow place, he will be lured to his death by the sirens who sing these beautiful songs. And that's sort of what's happening to us, I think. You know, we are being lured, basically in a way, in a rather directly to the great demise of our civilization by the fact that we can't take the long view on things. And a lot of what I'm going to have to say questions whether everything can be left to democratic processes. I think the appalling story that David Schindler told last night about land use in Alberta, right, is really an indictment of our political institutions, that we are not able to construct a way of thinking about our relationship to the natural world that will assure its continued flourishing into the future. Our generation is basically in the process of unraveling something that took 3.8 billion years to put together. And we have to take a real hard look at the fact that the institutions we have in place at the provincial level and at the national level don't work. So we need to find some way to tie ourselves to the mast, right, to basically keep from running down the resource base. And one little element in that, I think, is to reclassify how we think about certain things like water. So that's basically what I'm going to do. So everybody knows this. Water is not substitutable, right? If you don't have water, you die. And it's not only true of humans, but, of course, of all life. And water underpins the interdependency we have among ourselves as a species and with life generally. And I think it's very important, as Karen and others have talked about, not to segregate off humans and say, well, human needs come first. This has to be looked at very much as an integrated system. Now, once you make that rather, I think, simple and uncontroversial step, you then can move, I think, reasonably comfortably into thinking about drawing upon the traditions of fiduciary law. And this is a quote from a very famous book by Leonard Rotman. But the basic notion is that if you have a good on which society depends in an interdependent way for long periods of time, that good can be thought of in the context of fiduciary law. This is an idea, of course, that is very familiar to us, I think. It's when any person has the power over some entity, some resource base or some funds or anything like that, with a duty to preserve and enhance that entity or that resource base for another, then there's a fiduciary relationship in that case. And I think what we have the wisdom to do now is to say, well, the other entity that's cared for is not necessarily a person, right? That we have to think about caring for life generally, or what I've called in my work, we have to think about the well-being of life's commonwealth in general, and we have a fiduciary obligation to do that. So the principal elements of this are very simple. We have to act in good faith in discharging our fiduciary duties and not to seek our own interests or put our own concerns first. And this fits into other sort of concepts in law where the law generally focuses on setting up the rules of the road, how we relate to each other. Equity is concerned with a dimension of the law where issues of fairness have not been dealt with adequately. And the fiduciary notion reaches past these limits and sets the interdependence of relationships as the point of departure for how we think and for what gets to be characterized as legitimate. And so what kind of a good is water? Well, it's not a public good, at least as an economist would understand this. It's better understood as a common good. Technically, it can be owned, but it's morally wrong not to provide it, right? So this is the fiduciary dimension, right? So water kind of straddles In some ways, it fits the private paradigm, but in other ways, it doesn't. And we have what this fiduciary conception does is to highlight the common dimension or the degree to which all things depend upon water. And if water is denied, I think I would argue either to a person or to another species, even if there's no legal recourse in this case, there is an injustice, right? There is an obligation to provide for the flourishing of other persons and other species, both. And in the fiduciary paradigm, the person who is discharging these duties may not weigh his or her own interests any more heavily than the interests of anybody else. So we need to really rethink our institutional structure, I think. Democratic national governance has limited success in protecting the integrity of the Earth's life support systems. We heard that at length from David last night. Many waterways are degraded. The St. Lawrence has been mentioned already. The Chateauguay River, near where I have a farm, very, very polluted. It's green, basically, in the summer. There are, from Jeremy's work, I know, there are over-allocated rivers in southern Alberta, and there are even rivers, many, many, many rivers in the world now, including the Colorado, that don't even reach the ocean. Governments have been very poor at respecting their fiduciary duties to nature. We set up little parks here and there, but we don't really understand well and don't respond well to the complex interactive nature of the Earth's life support systems. And these examples, of course, are all over the place. Copenhagen is a poster child of the failure of current institutions to deal with our problems. The fiasco in Quebec with Mount Orford is another example of not recognizing a very simple and very clear fiduciary duties. And then, of course, we have the Alberta landscape. These are just some of the solutions that are out there. The fiduciary concept grounds a conception of justice toward life's commonwealth that transcends the limits of the current sort of political framework, which is individualistic. Political and an individualistic social, political, and legal frame of reference. So we have to explore the establishment of fiduciary trusteeships to protect water and other commons. And in Canada, you know, we have a rich tradition to draw on, which is the First Nations traditions, right, which have a world, in many cases, have worldviews or remnants of worldviews that allow for a much more respectful, thoughtful human nature relationship. And the trustee has at his or her disposal a number of means. The entity, water can be rationed, of course. We can use market mechanisms to achieve fiduciary goals. We could restore much of the damage that we've done to the natural world already. And, of course, certain kind of uses should be prohibited. Thank you very much.
Felt robbed. I didn't get the chance to use all these wonderful signs that they made up for me. Especially, I love that one. Don't you love that one? You know, that's right. Thank you very much. So now, if all works according to plan, we're going to get the other bookend, as it were, from Professor Quentin Cumin. We have the common law, and then we have the Code Civil, right? Thank you.
I don't have any slides or PowerPoint, so you will have to look at me. So here we are being asked to talk within a panel on the economics of water. And we are invited to discuss the stages of fresh water. One of the questions is water a public good? Should we sell our water? So I suggest that these questions are given an answer, at least in principle. In Bill 27, the Quebec Fresh Water Law enacted by the National Assembly in June 2009. The declared purpose of the legislation is to improve water management and preservation. I propose to highlight some of the features of the Freshwater Act most relevant to our discussion. That is to say, the legal definition of water and its consequences. And whether that fits with Peter's hopes, I'm not quite certain, but we'll see. The title of the Freshwater Law, An Act to Affirm the Collective Nature of Water Resources, and the mention that you find further on that water is part of our common heritage, indicate that water enjoys an exceptional status, a status that does not apply to minerals or to wild animals, for example. The notion of a collective resource is not devoid of legal meaning. The express reference made to the Civil Code of Quebec links the notion of a collective resource to the character attributed to air and water in the civilian legal tradition. The Civil Law of Quebec, as renewed in 1994, revised Civil Code, maintains the legal definition of water as a res communis, or a common thing. The definition of water as a collective resource applies to both groundwater and surface water. It follows that no one, not even the state, may claim to have a right of ownership in water. On the other hand, the Water Act acknowledges the right, and I'm quoting, the right of every natural person to have access to water that is safe for drinking, cooking, and personal hygiene. In keeping with the common resource character of water, four elements in the statute in the new act deserves to be highlighted. The Water Act defines the role of the state, declares as a principle the right of the public to participate in the decision-making process that affects water resources, and the right of every person to access any information about water resources held by public authorities, the so-called principle of transparency. Finally, amendments are introduced to the Environment Quality Act that will permit to identify, I think, and order the uses of water compatible with its character as a common resource. The Water Act described the provincial state as the custodian of water resources, vested with powers required for the protection and management of freshwater in the general interest and to further sustainable development. This, one could suggest, could equate to the idea of the fiduciary duty that we've just heard about, but this is vested in the state here, not generally in the public, but it does not, it could apply more generally than just to the guardian, the custodian of water resources. To achieve this, the Freshwater Act formally adopts the model of integrated concerted management by hydrologic unit or watershed basin, in which the participation of users is central. In each hydrologic unit is created a body, which we call generally watershed committee. Its member must be representative of all users and other parties whose activities have implication, water implication. The central to the mission of the Watershed Committee is the elaboration of a master plan that will contain all relevant water data, such as the state of the water and water-dependent natural resources, the identification of water uses and their effects, an inventory of ecologically important, fragile, or degraded zone, the measures required to protect and restore the quality or quantity of water resources, and the financial means needed to implement the plan. The Watershed Committee will have to update and to monitor the implementation of the master plan. Embodying the principle of transparency, the information of the public on water resources is facilitated or will be facilitated by the creation of a Bureau des connaissances de l'eau. This bureau, identified INDIAC as the water knowledge branch of the Department of the Environment, is charged with setting up an information system to collect all available data concerning water resources, to conserve and update such data, to disseminate the information, and to support development of learning and research in water resources. The Freshwater Act introduces amendments to the Environment Quality Act, which concerns surface and groundwater withdrawals and are in form, I think, with the collective nature of water resources. As a general rule, all water withdrawals will have to be authorized by the Ministry for the Environment. Presently, it's only underground water that are regulated. Amongst the few withdrawals not subject to authorization are withdrawals with the maximum flow of less than 70,000 liters per day for domestic purposes and agricultural purposes. The minister's power to authorize withdrawals of water is subject to a number of constraints and considerations. Generally, the minister must exercise his power or her power to authorize a withdrawal in such a manner as to ensure the protection of water resources, particularly by fostering sustainable, equitable, and efficient management in the light of the precautionary principle and climate change. I must say I was very happy to see that in the legislation. When considering an application for a withdrawal authorization, priority must be given to satisfying public health, sanitation, civil protection, and drinking water supply needs, and must take account as well of not only present needs, but future needs. Then the minister must aim to reconcile the protection needs of aquatic systems and the need with the needs of the other users, such as agriculture, aquaculture, industry, energy production, and human activities such as recreation and tourism. Finally, account must also be taken of present and future water needs for the development of rural and urban areas and the economic development of a region or a municipality. Members of the public are allowed to intervene with observation in the process of evaluation by the minister of an application for an authorization. And these authorizations may be subject to condition, especially condition with regard to site, the use of water, the quantity of water removed, and the quality in which it is to be returned. This authorization could be modified or removed entirely subsequently based on new facts or change of circumstances, and this is quite rather important. It is specially stipulated that such a change or removal of authorization would entail no compensation from the state. Finally, the previously enforced prohibition against transfers out of Quebec is integrated into the Environment Quality Act. An eventual lifting of the prohibition in a specific case of a planned transfer out of the province would have to be for a reason of public interest and submitted to public consultation in advance. I thank you.
Well, I think there's no doubt they were complimentary, so that's wonderful. We're now going to jump right over all that drought-stricken part of Canada and go all the way to the West Coast and hear from Professor Schreier.
Thank you. I'm neither an economist nor a policy wonk, so what you're going to get is a very simplistic scientific view on what a cost-efficient strategy should look like. I'm going to tell you a little bit about domestic agriculture and urban waste stuff and then hopefully summarize it. It doesn't matter whether you think water is a commodity or a common good, it is far cheaper to have demand control than looking for new supplies. It is far cheaper to conserve than having more domestic water treatment. It is far cheaper to have source control than cost of wastewater treatment. It is far cheaper to compensate rather than protecting flood structures. It is much more efficient to infiltrate stormwater rather than remove it. And it's far more efficient to use green water than blue water. Everybody knows this. These are the consumption, domestic consumption in Canada for the various cities, about 300 liters per person per day. In Europe, it's about half. But what you probably don't know, small communities do something much more dramatic. Here's some mountain communities in the West. They use up to 1,800 liters per person per day. These are clearly the most water-consumptive populations anywhere in the world. How much do they pay for it? Some people pay 15 cents per cubic meter. That's equivalent to $4,000 of bottled water. We pay about 63 cents per cubic meter. If you go anywhere else, you will see this interesting graph. The red is how much we consume, and the blue is how much we pay. The Canadians consume the most and pay the least, and in Europe they pay the most and consume the least. So why don't we have a national strategy that every house should be metered? We meter everything else. How simple is that? Now, a big question. How many of you have actually watched the ice hockey gold medal game? Hands up. What has that to do with water? This is what the city had to do. Now, let me interpret this to you. This is after the first period, after the second period, after the third period. And then we went into overtime, and everybody was scared shitless. Nobody went to the bathroom. But then you see this little bump there, and those are the guys who were drinking beer and couldn't hold it. But this is very serious. The city had to prepare water 3 days in advance for this event. Now, the city tells us our average flush is 15 liters per person. So, if we use 350 liters per person per day and we flush 105 liters, we're using a huge amount of water to disperse all these wonderful bacteria. Now, why don't we have a mandatory law across the Canada that every new house has to have low flush toilets with 3 and 6 liters? I actually did this a few years ago in my house. I go 7 times, and when you get older, you go more. And I flushed 168 liters per day down the tube, and now I'm flushing 27, so I'm saving 147 liters. How difficult is it to get a policy going in this? How about outdoor water? Natalie Brumauer, one of my graduate students, just finished a study in the Okanagan. 50% of bacterial-free domestic water is used for watering lawns. How many of you like to cut lawns? If we would have roof water storage, we use it for gardening. If we would have at least a foot of topsoil before you roll out your turf, or if we would do xeriscaping, you could reduce this 50% to 10%. Massive savings. Why don't we do this? There are now some bylaws in Kelowna where they're requiring a foot of topsoil before you do any lawn development. So, from a domestic point of view, extremely easy. Meter everybody, 30% reduction. Low flush toilets, another 30% reduction. Outdoor water use reduction. How simple is that? Now we get to agriculture. Most of agriculture is flood irrigated. We need to start looking at efficient irrigation. What I'm showing you here is all the crops which are grown in the Okanagan, the driest watershed in Canada. And you can see every crop has a different water requirement. So what we actually should be doing is we should grow the most cost-effective crop, which is also the most water-efficient crop. If you do that, I come up with a new water value. If you look at these crops here, this is how much water they use per hectare, and this is actually the value they get out of the farm gate value in terms of water. So you can see the grapes That's good news for all your wine drinkers. The grapes have the highest value. They use the least amount of water, and they get the best benefit for it. So this is very primitive economics. Now, everybody tells you have an obesity problem, you should change your diet, don't eat as much meat, because meat is very water consumptive, but I put up all these kind of beverages which you drink, and I'm showing you how much water it takes. A cup of coffee takes about 147 liters of water to produce. So milk and coffee and apple juice, very highly water consumptive. So my advice to you, if you want to be water conservation minded, you either become a teetotaler or a beer drinker, and you know where my preference is. Now, when it comes to conservation, we need not only to conserve the domestic water, we need to conserve also in the wastewater. Now, the problem we have with water treatment is we need multi-barrier approaches. One system is no longer good enough. Chartia, Cryptosporidium, and so on doesn't do anything with chlorination. So as we go up and up and up with treatment, the cost is going exponentially up. So if we reduce the amount we generate, this would be much more cost effective. Just to give you kind of an idea how problematic this is, Natalie Pristachevsky, one of our students, just did this study here. In BC this year, we had 275 boil water alerts. And look at these two figures here. 148 have been in place for more than 5 years, and 64 have been in place for more than 10 years. So all these people tell you, oh, you've got a problem, boil your water. Think of the energy we use. And nobody ever goes into the watershed and says, let's fix the problem. So now we get to urban stormwater. What have we been doing traditionally? We have been draining everything. Get it out of the way as fast as possible. So they're now saying we should actually retain and detain it. And we need to do this at different scales. You can do a lot at the property scale. We have to do it at the neighborhood scales. And we also have to do it at the watershed scale. These are the kind of things you can do. They're so easy to do. If you start with a green roof or your roof water harvesting, or you do minimize impervious surfaces, build pervious pavements, have topsoil in your garden, have a rain garden, and plant some trees, you can reduce your stormwater runoff from your system probably by 90%. At the neighborhood level, you're going to have to deal with parking lots and with roads. There you do something else. You infiltrate all the stuff. You build wetlands to detain it. And at the watershed level, you have to do something else. I'm showing you a couple of examples of this. We build wetlands in the city for stormwater management because it's the best filtering system and the best water storage system. We build now roads with no curbs and gutters. The water runs off into sand filters, which means it cleans up the water, it detains it, you don't have too much flooding. We build parking lots where all the crud from the parking lot goes into sand filters, and we had to go all the way to Bolivia to find a driveway like that. Typically what we do is we put everything into channels and water can only go up. Therefore, we need to do something else. We need to start dedicating certain areas in parks and agricultural areas where we deliberately store the flood water. And so these things are so easy to do, I don't know why we don't have leadership in this area. So in summary, we need mandatory metering nationally. We need conservation because it's the most cost-efficient way to go. We have low-impact design studies now which show a lot of innovations to reduce stormwater, but the economists need to help us a little bit to come to show how much cost-effective that stuff is. We need to rethink the treatment cost of drinking water and wastewater, and we need green water management. And the reason why we need to do that is because we're in for some wonderful times. This is what happens in the last 4 years in Vancouver. We had a big storm. The whole city was on boil water alert for 3 weeks. Followed by that, we have a snowstorm where 200 people had no power for 5 days. Then we had the windstorm in Stanley Park, which decapitated 3,000 people. Then we had a snowstorm. Sorry. Decapitated 3,000. That's a good one. And then we had the snowstorm over Christmas where no planes came in for 3 days. Then we had the highest temperature last summer. Then we had 26 out of 30 days of rain in November. And guess what? You heard the Olympics. We had the two warmest months ever recorded in Vancouver. Isn't that a wake-up call for all of us to start doing something? Thank you very much.
Thank you. You'd be interested to know that the same graph of toilet flushing was produced for Ottawa as well, except I don't remember it having the beer plip just before the final goal in the overtime period. So we're going to go back to the other virtuous crop area of Canada around the Niagara Peninsula, where they grow a lot of grapes, which get the best bang for buck is water, as far as water concerned. Professor Ronzetti.
Let me begin by thanking the organizers for the invitation to speak today at this, what I believe is a very important conference. Let me also point out I'm highly cognizant of the fact I'm one of the last things standing between you and lunch. I'm going to talk about what is perhaps a fairly pedestrian topic today, although it does require the inputs of scientists, engineers, accountants, and economists. Very briefly, I'm going to talk about what is full-cost pricing. It's been mentioned a couple of times thus far in the conference, and I think it's worthwhile just spending a moment talking about what most people are thinking about. Do we need it? If so, how do we get there, and what are the obstacles or challenges that might be facing us in that regard? Full-cost pricing is conceptually fairly straightforward to understand. You simply identify all of the inputs that you're using to, for example, supply potable water to a given region and measure their full costs. You can limit yourself, as is being done in Ontario under current regulations, to essentially purchased inputs, capital, labor, energy, materials, chemicals, etc., and ensure that you're fully costing those. Or you could go even further, as is in current legislation in the EU Water Framework Directive, where not only are purchase inputs required to be costed, but also the cost imposed on the environment through damages, through stormwater or sewage outfalls. And that certainly makes the measurement issue a lot more significant, but it also gives rise to lots of employment for environmental economists in Europe and Great Britain. So conceptually, it's fairly straightforward. You simply want to get your accounting correct, and you don't want to miss anything in terms of the inputs, whether they be simply the purchased human-made inputs, or more importantly, also perhaps include the cost to the environment that's being imposed through your operations. Of course, the devil's in the details. Measurement is remarkably difficult in some of these issues, although we can learn from other utilities where it's already been done. And also there's been a remarkable amount of progress in environmental accounting, evaluation of water resources, et cetera. And so it's on increasingly firm ground. Is it required? I would argue yes, for a variety of reasons, and I'm going to show you a few slides in a moment to provide you with a bit of evidence to support this. We are all in Canada familiar with aging infrastructure. I held my breath as I was driven in from the airport as I went through those underpasses that were being held up by bolts and wire. But not to say anything about Montreal, I've driven under similar overpasses in many parts of Canada. I'll show you some data in a moment showing how inadequately revenued the municipal systems are in Canada and the deficits that they've been facing. We've seen a bit of information already about rising water demands, and certainly as we look into the future, with increasing per capita consumption, increasing incomes, it's quite remarkable. If you've flown over southern Ontario as many times as I have, it's quite amazing to see the growth in the little blue squares behind houses over the last 20 or 30 years and the number of houses that have swimming pools. And so increased use of water, increased use of water-using appliances are all pointing towards increasing demands on these systems. And then finally, you know, there's been an ample amount of evidence with respect to climate change. I would just point out that climate change hits water utilities on a whole bunch of fronts. On the one hand, it makes the raw water supplies less certain, hence raising their costs because perhaps you may have to engage in more storage and treatment. On the other hand, climate change in some areas may raise demands. And so, it would also present an additional threat to infrastructure. So water agencies are really being faced by climate change on a number of different fronts, and all of these things have to be reflected in the cost accounting and ultimately, I would argue, the pricing. So let's just look briefly at some evidence in this regard. I apologize. So this essentially is, how old is your infrastructure? The bad news is, with respect to, with the exception of one system, it's all getting older. Water systems very recently have begun to get slightly less old because there's been a remarkable infusion of spending on water systems, in part because of federal government and provincial government funding as a result of some well-publicized crises. But with the exception of water, if you look in particular at our sewer systems and our wastewater treatment systems, they're aging very rapidly. And so aging simply means you're not putting the money into replacing these infrastructure. Now, why that is the case is shown by the next slide. And I apologize for the size of the font. All you really have to look at is the two top lines. The solid black line is essentially the total cost of supplying water if you sum across all the municipalities in Canada, capital costs and operating costs. And it's been rising gradually until the 2000 and then rising rapidly. The line immediately below it, the dotted line, is the amount of revenues that these same agencies have been earning. And with the exception of the year 2001, over the last 20-something years, this group of agencies has been earning less money than it's been spending. And unless you're hoping for a bailout from some senior federal government, you just can't do this. You can't run any kind of agency, public or private, for 25 years where you're consistently spending billions of dollars more than you're earning. You know, somebody's going to have to pick up the tab at some point. And part of that is seen in aging infrastructure. So I would argue that the current system is not sustainable. These agencies are faced with a series of significant challenges, aging infrastructure being one, rising demands being another. And when we turn to possible solutions, one of the obvious policy instruments that is appropriate for this type of conference to consider is whether prices are appropriate. And I would argue that the current set of prices in Canada at the municipal level, and perhaps if you like, we can, everything I'm saying at this moment is talking about municipal pricing. We could also talk about the pricing of direct abstractions. That raises a whole other set of issues, but we can talk about that later if you like. We have incomplete cost accounting, and no matter how clever your pricing is, if you're just simply not measuring the cost of business, it can't translate into the right prices. By failing to recognize the damage imposed on our ecosystems and our aquatic ecosystems through sewage outfalls, storm outfalls, and not reflecting those costs in prices, we're again underestimating the cost of supply. There are all sorts of bizarre and poorly understood cross-subsidies that go on through these pricing mechanisms. In some cities, households pay more than businesses, and in other cities, businesses pay more than households. Much of this was unintended, it's poorly understood, it's completely opaque, and it's not the type of thing that, from a public policy point of view, is something that we want to pursue. And finally, if the prices are too low, you're very, very strongly stifling innovation. You know, imagine some clever engineer from McGill or some other school who gets her first job at some large water-using factory, and she goes to her boss one day and says, Boss, I've got this great idea. I could save the factory 20% of our water use. And the boss turns around and says, we get our water from the lake for free. What are you doing? Go save me energy costs. Go save me labor costs. Do something useful. And so if it's cheap, you don't economize on it. You don't get innovative. And as a result, we're stuck in old patterns. A variation on the slide that Hans just showed, something that's just out from the OECD very recently. Again, you don't need to look, you know, you don't need to guess where to look where Canada is. Look, you know, like the friendly giant said, look down, look way down. And there's Canada at your far left. Unfortunately, for some reason, the U.S. isn't in here. I guess they didn't get their data in on time or something. But the message is very, very clear. And these international comparisons, you've got to be careful about them. You know, you want to be comparing apples and apples. But you can easily argue that there are countries that are hydrologically, that are have the same level of economic development, that have the same level of population density, essentially a lot of the drivers that determine costs and demands for water. And so this is a fair comparison. You know, we're not comparing apples and oranges. Really, we are underpricing our water. And as a result, you get the levels of consumption that you've seen, you get the aging infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. Part of the problem, as was mentioned a moment ago, is that we don't meter everyone. Approximately, now again, the data are old, but the most recent ones that are available indicate that about a quarter of the Canadian population doesn't have its water metered. They're predominantly small cities, and I recognize that small cities and small municipal systems provide particular challenges in terms of scale of operation. But even still, if you know, the old maximum in public policy is if you don't measure it, you can't manage it. And we simply don't know what a quarter of the population is doing by way of its individual water uses. So if we are going to reform prices and push them more in the direction of truly informing water users of their full costs of consumption, what things would we have to acknowledge as potential challenges in moving forward? The first one is simply technical. You know, how do we write down the accounting rules that get us to where we want to be? Well, fortunately, Canada is populated with really clever accountants and really clever engineers and sort of clever economists. And so the first issue is just technical. How do you design the rules that all the utilities, and again, this is one of those examples, I think, we've seen a couple of them pop up throughout the conference, where the federal government could clearly take a role. You know, you write one set of rules for accounting, and they could apply across the country. And you don't need that duplication, the kind of stuff that Karen was talking about earlier. And we could also learn. The US EPA has already been working on this. It's the type of thing we wouldn't have to be reinventing the wheel. We clearly want to be clever enough to set new prices in a manner that does not harm the urban poor. And this is a significant constraint, but it's not one that's insurmountable. It's already been done in innovative cities such as Seattle, Los Angeles. And again, it's just a technical issue. You have to do the right measurements, and you have to put it into your formulas, but it's not an insurmountable challenge. It's just something you acknowledge and you write in and you say, we're not going to hurt anybody by doing this. We're not going to hurt the poor. City councils, I don't know how to get around that. I'm not a political scientist, but I do know that time and time again, reforms on water level, water rates have been stymied by city councils who have perhaps a different set objective function in mind in terms of what they want to pursue. And unfortunately, rate setting becomes politicized, and it's, in my mind, a significant issue that we have to deal with if we're going to think about reforms in a serious way. I would argue, finally, that infrastructure grants are part of the problem rather than the solution. Simply put, it doesn't make sense to have people in Lethbridge paying the water bills of people in Windsor, Nova Scotia. And that's what infrastructure grants do. They simply transfer money from households in one part of the country to other households. The federal government has no money. They just tax one part of the country and pay to another. And the difficulty is if you reinforce bad behavior, you know, everyone in the room who's had little kids knows this, it just continues. And so you get a city that has a burgeoning demand problem, is bursting at the seams because they've underpriced water, and what do? Well, you give them more money so they can build more capacity so they can just continue the cycle. It just doesn't make sense. And again, it's something that could be fairly easily attacked. The US EPA, for example, has conditions on its certain types of its capital grants that you have to have a conservation plan in place in order to be eligible for funding. So what do we do? Very simply, again, to mimic what Hans has said, universal metering. And again, the technology of metering is changing very rapidly. It isn't just that we can move to meters that will be read once every quarter or something like that. There's an enormous revolution going on in electrical metering, and maybe in a decade's time we'll catch up to them and we'll have smart water meters that will give us real-time data of the type that water managers require. We need the accountants and the engineers and the economists to put their heads together and write down a set of clear rules about how to move to full cost accounting. And again, that's just a technical issue. I would argue that we need to tie prices closer to costs so that for all the folks who like to water their lawns on July 5th and the hottest day of the year, I'm all for it. I just want to hit you with a very large water bill to reflect the cost of what. And if you really want to buy strawberries in the winter, well, you pay more. So if you want to water your lawn in the middle of the summer, you're going to pay more too. Depoliticized rate setting. I think this is it. You know, Karen talked about how remarkably decentralized Canada is. Water pricing is captive by these individual cities across Canada. We have no centralization of this and no sensible rules. And again, we can learn from the example of municipal electrical pricing, where there are province-wide boards where it's done as a matter of engineering and accounting and liabilities and assets, rather than does the city council approve. And finally, I would argue that we should move strongly in the direction of making our infrastructure grants conditional on reforms. You want more grants? Show us you're doing something sensible. So, to conclude, at the municipal level, municipal water suppliers and municipal sewage treatment agencies face a remarkable number of challenges, and I think it's one of the shining success stories in Canada, how well they do their jobs with the resources that have been made available to them. Some of the problems, not all of them certainly, but some of the problems that municipal agencies face, I think, could be addressed by improved cost accounting and the next step, moving to full cost pricing. We tie capital grants to expectations of conservation measures. And finally, I would argue that all of this that I've been talking about has in no way any connection to privatization or sale of municipal agencies. In fact, my entire concern is strengthening public agencies rather than weakening them. Thank you.
Thank you to all of the panelists for being sprightly and provocative. We are going to go to 12:30, so there's going to be time for questions from the audience for sure. But I had one question I wanted to roll down the length of the panel. I wanted to ask about Eureka moments. Was there anything that any other panelist said that caused you to say Eureka? In other words, I have an idea. The light bulb went on in your head and you said, ah, we could do something about that.
I have one, yeah.
It could be something you said, of course, but I'd rather it wasn't.
No, in David's talk last night, that remarkable slide that showed if we take a section of boreal forest and we can either treat it as an amazing asset that has lots of value, or we can treat it as a factory to produce toilet paper. And historically, we've been doing the latter, but I think we need to increasingly recognize all of the values. Some we can measure, some we can measure poorly, some we can't measure. And recognize that. I think that was a remarkable insight.
Okay, anybody else?
Well, what strikes me most is because we are such big water guzzlers, it is so easy to reduce consumption.
Yeah.
And I don't know why we can't do it. I mean, it won't cost you anything. It's a slight behavioral change. You're not going to suffer if you have 30% less water use. So I cannot understand why the public just cannot buy into this.
But you live in Vancouver, right?
Yes.
So how much? But you didn't save anything by saving water.
Well,
your water bill didn't go down.
Vancouver is not even metered.
Well, so you know, other than being a good person, why would you do it?
I'm trying to show leadership because if I shout,
sure.
If I shout, I better show that I have something to back it up with.
So, when you mentioned low flush toilets, as I thought about this. We just have had programs both in the United States and Canada which amount to cash for clunkers. If you're driving an old car that's polluting more, we'll pay you to upgrade it. Is there any reason? I mean, I know nothing about economics, which is why they chose me to moderate this panel. is there any reason why a cash for clunkers program wouldn't work for 6-liter toilets? You trade in your 6-liter toilet, get a 3-liter or 1.5-liter toilet?
They exist.
Not in Ottawa. Maybe they do elsewhere.
They're isolated and they're across the country. Historically, low-flush toilets have gotten a bit of a bad name because the engineering was problematic. My understanding is the current generation of flush toilets works much better, and there are programs in place where cities will give you a grant for that type of thing.
Well, we built 30,000 new houses in BC last year. And 15% put in low-flush toilets.
Yeah.
We're missing the boat because if you build a new house, you're not going to change your plumbing for the next 30 years.
Yeah.
Why don't we have a mandatory national policy that every new house has to have it? It's not going to cost you anything.
Just put it in the code.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we have some roving microphones. And they're about to go roaming. There's some people right here. You should say who you are, and if you represent anything other than yourself, you should say that. And if it's for the panel, that's fine. But if anybody specifically, address it to them. Go ahead.
Tony Moss, Director of the Freshwater Program at WWF Canada. My question is mostly for Stephen, actually. One of the things I don't think you spoke about in your presentation is elasticity of the pricing mechanism and thinking of it as a tool for water efficiency. And when I sit down with even my colleagues who work for a large conservation organization and tell them in Toronto that their water rates are going up by something like 9% a year right now, for the next few years anyhow, they have no clue. So it's not showing up on their radar in terms of their bill going up. So one of the things that I've always felt is that because we're starting at such a low level, how do we get around that challenge of even an increase of 10%, which might seem like a lot, but on a dollar value, you know, 10% of a little bit isn't a lot, right?
If I understand your question, the evidence shows that people respond to prices. If you raise the price of water, in the next month, there's a limited number of things you can do. You can shout out your kids to turn off the tap, and that. But over the next year or two, when the plumbing needs to be changed, or when your company is retrofitting, then you make bigger changes. And you know, the evidence suggests that you know a 10% increase in price, all of the things equal, will lead to you know a 6 or 7% decrease in water use over the long run. And more importantly, it's not just that people change their habits, but you get all those clever tinkerers and innovators and thinkers now thinking about new technologies, improved toilets and all these other things. And these now come on the market because people demand them.
Professor Brown?
Yeah, I just wanted to get into that just for a moment on the issue of full cost pricing. I think it's much more problematical than it seems, although I'm for higher prices. So I want to make that clear in the beginning. But in the case of full cost pricing, you're, of course, allowing harm to be done to ecosystems. You're just having to compensate for it, right? You're still – so that's one of the things you're measuring. And it's much sounder public policy, in my view, to set up constraints – that can't or barriers that can't be crossed in the protection of ecosystems, even if you're willing to pay the cost, and then set your price structure within those basically biophysically determined constraints. Also makes a lot less work for economists.
There, sorry, go ahead.
I'm Isabel, I'm a student. I had a bit the same question, but I wanted to know actually if you would put like the same price for residents and companies, taking in consideration that industrial and companies are the main users, and I think they're making a big difference while people are not consuming that much. So I think it should be it shouldn't be in the same boat. And I had a question as well for Madeleine. I was wondering about the withdrawal of water in the Freshwater Act. I read somewhere that companies were responsible of seeing how much water they took from groundwater and surface water. I'm just wondering, like, how do you control that? I know there's some parts of the government that are responsible for that, but I have a problem finding how can we trust that. We have to deal with like the goodwill of the companies. So I would like to have your opinion on it. Thanks.
I'm not sure that I understand the question, in fact. Can you rephrase it?
Sorry, I'm Francophone, definitely, so I have a bit of problem in English, but...
Moi aussi.
Ben, vous êtes francophone? OK. Ben, en réalité, c'est ça, c'est pour les l'eau qui est prélevée par les compagnies. Vous avez dit, dans le fond, la loi qui est passée au mois de juin, il y a plus de contrôle qui est fait par rapport à ça, puis on a besoin de demander une autorisation de prélèvement au gouvernement, mm-hmm. ce qui est déjà un avancement spectaculaire, mm-hmm. c'est merveilleux. Je me demandais, au niveau du contrôle de ces prélèvements-là, j'ai lu, je me rappelle pas à quel endroit, mais j'ai lu que c'était en fait les compagnies qui étaient responsables de dire la quantité d'eau qu'ils prélevaient. Donc, je me pose la question à savoir, faut se fier en fait sur la bonne volonté de la compagnie, à savoir s'il n'y a pas des abus à ce niveau-là. Je sais que c'est un peu complexe de savoir, mais je me demandais votre opinion à ce sujet-là. Merci.
Effectivement, c'est à chaque année, ou même est-ce que c'est deux fois par année, on doit faire rapport au ministère des quantités qui ont été prélevées. Mais la déclaration émane de l'utilisateur, mais elle doit être contre-vérifiée par un spécialiste. Donc, il y a un mécanisme, je pense, de vérification pour s'assurer de la véracité de la déclaration. Et on va venir éventuellement avec l'imposition de tarifs, pour, en tout cas pour les entreprises, pour les usages commerciaux de l'eau. Et ça, évidemment, à partir du moment où on a les données quant au volume de consommation, la question des tarifs, évidemment, va être beaucoup plus facile à à mettre en place. Je ne sais pas si ça répond à votre question.
La différence entre ce qui était dit par la compagnie et ce qui était prélevé par la suite
c'est
par le
nouveau.
Gouvernement.
C'est ouais, tout nouveau, c'est ça, là, le rapport. Donc, il ne peut pas y avoir de statistiques, je crois.
Non, mais c'est les cas jusqu'à présent, en fait.
Pardon?
C'était les cas jusqu'à présent qui avaient été prélevés. Je pose une question, en fait, justement, c'est nouveau.
Non,
je veux savoir votre opinion.
Le règlement qui exige maintenant qu'on fasse rapport des prélèvements et est entré en vigueur, qu'est-ce que c'était, septembre 2009. Donc, on n'a pas d'histoire encore, là. Mais il y a un mécanisme de contrôle. Est-ce que ça va être suffisant? Bon. Si un utilisateur fait des fausses déclarations, le ministère pourra mettre fin à l'autorisation, hein, et sans compensation.
Just quickly, your prices follow from your objectives. You decide what you want to achieve in your prices, and then the price, actual level of price, follows from that. So you first have to decide what it is you want prices to do. Is it just to recover costs? Is it to encourage conservation? Is it to et cetera, et cetera? And so that's the general principle. If you presume that prices are meant to reflect costs, then if industry and residents have different costs associated with their supply, then they will face different prices. But if they don't, then there's no basis for difference. But you have to be careful. I believe in most municipalities, industries don't, in Canada at least, most households and industry are roughly similar. You may be thinking of industrial water use that's not connected to municipal systems, like large factories where it's a very large quantity of water. But that is provincial allocation permits, and it's a different issue about pricing those.
Well, I'll give you another example. One of my former PhD students is a hydrologist, and he got hired by Deloitte. He's the first hydrologist being hired by an accounting company. And his mandate is to have water accounting for industry. And I talked to him the other day, and I said, well, how are you faring? And he said, it is an incredible challenge because it never even comes up on the budget. Energy is way up there. Everybody wants to cut down their carbon footprint. Water, it's not on the horizon. So how do we bring this in an economic context? That's the big struggle.
I'm Andrew Osteen from the University of Guelph. I guess that's directed to you, Hansa, again. You were talking, what was really interesting was hearing about the rural communities that actually have an exorbitant amount of water that they use, 1,800 liters per day. I mean, that's shocking. And to know in rural systems, that goes right back into a septic system. That's even more shocking to me because that's what my background is. I deal with wastewater that comes from rural areas. So how these people are on their own well. They have their own system. They are not connected at all to any larger grid. So how do you try to impress upon people that they're not only impacting groundwater reserves, but they're also could be polluting a high amount. If it's 1,800 liters a day, that's really, really a lot. So just your comments on that I would like.
Well, I'm going to be completely out of the political realm. I think BC is the banana republic when it comes to groundwater. We have no groundwater legislation. You can pump as much water as you want from your property, and you don't care what the neighbor does. And I think, you know, time has come when we have to bite the bullet, because we've now looked at rural areas and septic system density, and there's a really clear relationship. The closer your septic system is to your groundwater, you're going to have problems. And so this needs massive public education, and I think the biggest problem is why there's such a reluctance is it costs you a lot of money to drill your well. So you spend $15,000-$20,000 to drill your well, and then the government comes and says, I'm going to tax you. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to work, right? So we need to start from scratch, and we need flexible laws. This is an oxymoron. But if we don't allow flexibility within the law, we don't get innovation. And right now, the water laws are so bloody archaic, they always look backwards. And now we have climate change, which is completely new, and I tell all the lawyers, start thinking about the law, about climate change and water. That means you're going to have to think completely differently. How do you get the law facility, the fraternity, to actually start thinking about this? Those are really interesting things we need to push.
Peter?
No, just a comment on that. I completely agree, but if you have, you're going to have problems that come up over many decades, you're going to need a frame of reference that most legislatures and most city councils don't have. So that's an argument in favor, I think, of some sort of regulatory body like a public utility that regulates electricity or something, so that it has the mandate to look out over a very long period of time and manage this good for the benefit of both humans and ecosystems.
Way back in the corner there, was there somebody? Okay, move down. Uncharacteristically for me, I'm seeing better on the right than on the left. So if there are people on the left who actually want to ask questions, okay, thank you. I haven't been spotting you very well. So now, go ahead.
Thanks. Hi, my name's Chris. I work for a local radio station, CKUT. I have a question about the full cost pricing of water. You mentioned that it wouldn't affect low-income households, but you didn't actually elaborate on how that would be done. I was sort of curious as to what measures have been taken in past projects.
It certainly could. If you just blindly go ahead and say, well, we haven't been looking at costs correctly, and hence we have to raise our prices, that would almost certainly have a regressive effect, because the amount of money that the households spend on water as a percentage of their income falls as income rises. So if you raise the price of water, it could potentially have a serious effect. One of the big complications is typically poor people, as a proportion, live more in rental units, and they don't tend to be metered. So there's that complication, you know, the connection between water prices and impact. But in general, there are a variety of ways that you can do it. One is so-called lifeline price structures, where a certain amount of water is priced below cost or even given for free. And that is, you know, you can figure out what quantity it is, but it's basically, this is the amount that people need. And we're just going to, as a group, say, look, we're not going to recover the cost on that. And then you may have increasing block rates after that, or some kind of inclining structure, peak load pricing, because peaks are generally generated by higher income people because they have more water using capital, that type of thing. So again, it's just a technical issue. You set your goal, which is we want to achieve full cost recovery, we want to promote conservation, but we don't want to change, for example, the water budget of the lowest 15-20% of the population. And then you just set your prices accordingly. So it's not. And as I said, if you look at the examples of Seattle and Los Angeles is probably the most interesting one, where they went through this exercise and they had community involvement, they had technical experts, and they sat down and as a group they decided that this was their set of goals and the result was this set of prices.
You sort of spoke disparagingly about having people in Alberta paying for the water if people in other parts of the country. And I was wondering how this sort of isn't another sort of cross-subsidization.
Different. That was in the context of infrastructure grants. And what I was arguing there is that the common perception is that the federal government or perhaps the province gives money to the municipalities. That's not true. It's households that give money to households. It just works through the tax system. And so the infrastructure grant system is really just a way of some households in one part of the country supporting the water use and other types of uses of households. Now, that may be something that we as a society want to do, but I think it needs to be better understood. And more importantly, I think the grants need to be tied with performance conditions so that if we are going to put money into a city, that city needs to be showing that they're doing, you know, reasonable measures to reduce consumption rather than continuing underpricing, which is just continuing the cycle of needing more and more infrastructure money. I've had more than one mayor suggest anonymously that the game is very clear. You just push your system until it breaks down, and then you hope Ottawa saves you. It's not complicated, unfortunately.
Just put bore down here for a question, or core down. Shouldn't automatically people who have swimming pools pay a surtax? Whether, you know,
for instance, in Britain, when you get your Ministry of Transport license for your car, it costs you more if you have a larger capacity car. Whether it sits in the garage and never goes anywhere, you pay more because you are more consuming, as it were. If somebody puts in a swimming pool, prima facie, shouldn't they be paying a surtax?
Well, it depends what you mean by surtax.
Extra water charge above beyond anybody else's water charge.
If you don't like swimming pools and you want to punish that.
If you think a swimming pool is a huge body of water.
Well, I would argue that if you think that filling swimming pools in the middle of the summer is a costly thing, then the price of any water use in the summer should reflect.
So
it would
be captured by that bimodal method.
I mean, it's not clear that, you know, my wife watering her garden in the middle of July is socially different from my neighbor filling her swimming pool. My wife would argue differently, but she's not here. And this is being taped.
And this is being taped.
But
and she grows vegetables too, right?
She does. But in any case, the point is, pricing follows objectives. You decide as a collective what are your objectives, what are you trying to achieve? Protect the environment, provide everyone with potable drinking water, provide enough resources so that the system is financially viable and engineeringly sound, provide incentives for innovation. And then you just work and say, okay, what are the prices that achieve our goals? And the key thing is our prices do none of those things right now. We're very, very clever in building systems. We're remarkably clever in chemically treating water. We've just gotten part of the equation wrong.
Hello, my name is Sao Mai Nguyen, and I'd like to ask a question as a law student. As a law student who is thinking of going into environmental law, but who at the same time doesn't understand half of the scientific data and the economic vocabulary that has been presented throughout these last 2 days. So let's just put it this way. When Professor Schindler yesterday posted a slide with the legislator who's blind and who is going towards the cliff, maybe he is blind but unintentionally. Because when I read the Bill 27, the Water Act that Professor Quentin-Cumet talked about, and when I read about Res Communis, your article, to me it made sense. But now I realize that maybe it makes sense to me because it is legal. So now I take advantage of a situation where there's a panel with different specialties to ask, does it make sense to all of you as it does to me? I guess the underlying question is, when you are of different specialties, you sometimes have different frame of minds. And so as different people from different specialties, how do you mesh? How do you come to an approach of communication that will bring to effective solutions?
Professor Brown.
Great question. I'm going to give two answers. One very simple. If you have a choice of a member of parliament or of the National Assembly who has a scientific background, unless he or she is an idiot in every other way, elect them, because it's a big problem. Right? And the more complicated answer is I think that you've really hit on something that's a very deep structural issue, that if you look at the curriculum of a university like McGill, and you think of it in terms of what paradigmatic worldview lies behind the curriculum. In many cases, it's the evolutionary scientific paradigm, right? So certainly in the sciences, you would have that in psychology, and many other disciplines are going to line up with the scientific paradigm. But many of the things that we study at a university like McGill are still embedded in a Judeo-Christian paradigm, which is the sort of root of our culture. And I think the things that are still embedded in the Judeo-Christian paradigm are the law, ethics, economics, and politics. And that one of the reasons we have very profound problems in our society is our ethical and normative systems have no systematic connection to our scientific understanding of the world.
You've been waiting patiently. I actually meant two in front, but this gentleman here had his hand up first.
Hi, Richard Lehan from the law faculty, working together with Peter Brown on this. I just wanted to underline one point that Peter was stressing in relation both to what Stephen and Hans have mentioned. Hans's question about why is something that is apparent not done is because it's not valued. The economic approach, as Professor Brown has pointed out, will only touch to a certain point the question of value. So I think I just wanted to stress again what Professor Brown was trying to work out, is that the shift in values has to be modeled both within existing normative structures but also reach past them. So I think his assessment of not just finding practical solutions, which should evidently be implemented, but until certain things are simply actually taken out of our capacity to use them for immediate gain, only then do they actually take on the value that Professor Schreier is talking about. So we actually have to have in our social imaginary, our political imaginary, the ability to create those spaces. So I just wanted to once again underline that as much as the practical and the economic are systemically necessary, the value shift has to be modeled in an equally differentiated way. And that's why I wanted to support Peter Brown's initiative.
If I could just quickly respond.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting areas in economic valuation recently is the notion of an option value, that we go out and ask households whether they'd be willing to pay to preserve endangered species. And these are species that the average Canadian will never have any physical proximity to or personal contact with, blue whales and pandas. And it's remarkable, and every environmental NGO knows this, that large amounts of money are being paid out on a daily basis by people to support ecosystems and endangered species that they'll never see. And that, and you say, why? And they say, because I place value on its existence. I place value on knowing that my children have the option 30 years from now of being able to see a great panda or a blue whale. And this really is surprising. And this really indicates that people have very deeply held beliefs and that they can communicate them in a way that through economic valuation we can point to policymakers and say, look, it may not be current consumption. There is value today on keeping it available for 30 or 40 or 50 years. And so what sounded like kind of pedestrian calculations have at their heart the types of things that you're talking about, I think.
Did you, you still, this lady here.
Hi, I'd like to offer not
you
just
are?
To, oh, sorry, Myla Craig, and I'm with Milani, and I'm an independent consultant on responsible and sustainable investing. So I'd like to offer a different sort of perspective to the panel, but also to everyone in this room. You know, I think we underestimate the power that we have as individuals. And, you know, if I ask the question, how many people in this room have a pension fund? How many people in this room have investment funds? Steve, thank you so much for bringing forward the whole full cost accounting. There's a movement in Canada right now which is responsible investing, and it's really trying to get corporations to come forward with transparency and accountability on environmental, social, and governance issues. And, you know, the environmental water, I mean, when you said 87%, someone today, one of the presenters, 87% of our water usage is for four industries in this country. How many of those companies are public companies in Canada? We own those companies. We as individuals in our pension funds. How many of us know if our pension fund has a responsible investment policy? That's extremely powerful. If we're asking those questions, our pension funds will put it forward. It will force the investment industry to move forward on this and ask the questions of the corporations to file the right information, measure the right information. It's not happening. We need it to happen. And, you know, it's one other solution. Obviously, there's many. But I think that there's a lot of power in this room and your colleagues, et cetera, to move forward. And I just wanted to present it. I just think there's a great opportunity here for all of us. And it's about asking the right questions.
Yeah, the code is CRS, Corporate Social Responsibility. And you'll find it in some annual reports. Banks particularly are twitchy. But back there, there was a question, was there not? Did you not have a question to ask?
Yes, I did.
Like 15 minutes ago?
Thank you.
Just take a while.
Thank you. Gail Kranzberg, McMaster University. Very, very interesting panel. Thank you. It's a very small question because the big questions other people have used up, so thank you. Why is it, can we go back in history, for those of you who are scholars of this, why does Canada have the lowest pricing on water anywhere in the world. Why? How did that come to be? What was the mentality? Especially since we don't have the most renewable resources anywhere on the planet. That's been made clear to us. So what started this, and how do we turn it around?
You saw the figure earlier that we had 6.6, I think it was, percent of the... But what should have been on that same graph was what percentage of the world's population do we have? Why I think we have that mind fixation is because per capita we have an awful lot of water in this country. Is it the highest? I figured it might be if you divide it into a mere 33 million people. So, sure, it's not a huge percentage compared to some other people, but they both have bigger populations than we do.
But water has nothing to do with it.
We're talking about a mindset here.
No, but the fact that it's the capital and the labor and the materials that are underpriced. I'm not even talking about putting the value of water into the equation. That's a whole other different step. Why is it that municipal governments have so failed in their accounting? And I think it's possibly two reasons. One, water's not unique. I mean, our roads, a lot of our public infrastructure is improperly accounted for. You know, you can use almost every major highway in Canada for free. And so they're undervalued and overused. And so a lot of our public capital shares that characteristic. And it's also partially because for a long time, I think water agencies were just a simple department within a municipal government rather than a standalone utility. And if it were a standalone utility, it would have different cost accounting rules. It would have to report differently. You couldn't cross-subsidize. And so I think that was a big part of it, too. But you're right. It's just a strange thing that has arisen. And you look at other countries that have the same hydrology, the same population, and it's just been different.
So we probably have time for one more question and answer. Who has the most important question left to ask? You're absolutely positive you've got the most important question right there. The lady in purple gets a microphone.
Hello, I'm Penelope Ma, and I'm studying integrated water resources management at McGill University. And my very important question is, I have 1.5 questions, but they're both, the half might not be, but the important question is, I'm wondering at what stage you think Canada is in terms of moving towards full cost water pricing. And are we at the beginning of a really slow change towards it, or are we even moving towards it? Or are we waiting for this huge bump of we need universal water metering first and then trying to move on from there? That's my question. And then the half question is for Mr. Schreier. And then you showed pictures of toilets. And then it made me think of when automatic flush toilets came out. Sometimes it flushes like 3 times when I'm in there. And I was wondering what you think of... I'm wondering what you think of automatic flush toilets and water conservation and the whole automated water things and everything. So,
I was feeling good until you asked that question. Credit where credit is due. The final report of the inquiry on federal water policy, which is now essentially 25 years old, so, acknowledge them for what they did. They called for full cost accounting and full cost pricing, and it's taken 25 years. There is an initiative in the province of Ontario where it has now been written into law that this will be required. And what's remarkable is they decide to do it. You can't get anywhere, other than, of course, the tragedy of Walkerton and some of the fallout of that. They just decided to do it. And so, we're Canadian. Every government spends half its time looking over its shoulder. And so hopefully the other provinces will see what happened in Ontario and follow their example. I know there's a lot of interest, although, to be perfectly honest, Quebec is perhaps an exception in that regard, in the direction it's moving.
And regarding low flush toilets, where is Bob Sanford? He told me he bought this Niagara flush where it's transparent, so you see the water go down, right, when you flush. And he was telling me for the first months he used far more water than anything else because all the kids in the neighborhood wanted to see how it works. But let me assure you, Australia has gone through a complete evaluation of all the systems which exist in the world. And they have come up, if you go to their website, they have rated all the systems. Yes, there were early problems. Today, it's no longer a technical problem. And it's not a cost problem either. is actually cheaper than the conventional toilet. And just as an add-on, the Capital Regional District in Victoria has this replacement program. They're recovering some of the cost by breaking up the porcelain and sell it for gardening because people like to have these white little garden things. Interesting idea.
So if you had almost the most important question waiting to be asked, you can always get the panelists on their way, trying to make their way out the door to lunch. And I was going to make one comment just before I turn it back over to Bob Slater, which was that the question was raised about how do we get municipal governments to act in a progressive fashion when it comes to water. And I would say you look at the example of the Good Roads Association, which for 50 years has been getting municipal governments to act in a progressive and foresighted fashion when it comes to roads. There are existing models for how to do this at the municipal level. Bob?
Well, on behalf of you, let me thank... An excellent end to the morning session. A wonderful taster for lunch, which is to follow right now outside here. And you are requested, absolutely requested, to be in your seats for 1:30. In your seats, sitting, attendant, waiting for the Minister of the Environment, Jim Prentice. Thank you. Excellent.